Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you very much to François for the organization of and the invitation to that very nice event. Thanks to Mariam, who contributed to the organization, and Grégory is not here, but that's really a wonderful organization. So I'm going to talk to you about money. It seems from a start that there are two main and important questions about money. The first is, what is money? And the second is, how can we get more of it? The good news is that I have an answer to one of these questions, and the bad news is that it's an answer to the first question. So I'm going to defend a view about the nature of money. This is a view labeled here the pure commodity theory of money. It's not completely a new view. What I think is that there used to be a standard view of money called the standard commodity theory of money. That was very popular among economists and philosophers. It's nowadays nearly unanimously rejected, at least among philosophers, sociologists, anthropologists, and by many economists. But I think the core of this theory is true, and the core of this theory is what I shall call in a second part the pure commodity theory. So I shall spend some time defining that theory, and then I shall contrast it with what is considered to be one chief contender against the commodity theory of money, which is called the claim theory of money. And I shall argue that the pure commodity theory is not just better than the claim theory, but that in fact that it can swallow the claim theory, that the claim theory is a form of the pure commodity theory. So let us start by the standard commodity theory. The key idea of the standard commodity theory is that money is a commodity that was selected to function as a medium of exchange. And the starting point of the theory is the idea that in a barter situation, which we assume is a starting situation, we face a big problem, which is the problem of lack of double coincidence of wants. So what is the problem? This is a case in which we don't have the problem here. Each agent here has exactly what the other wants, so there is an easy solution to that. They just have to swap goods, and everybody is happy. The problem is that when we have more than one agent, we face the following worry. It's kind of obvious that in that case, there is a redistribution of goods that would satisfy all the agents better, namely that distribution. Everybody has what he wants, okay? But the problem is that if we let the agent just discuss with each other, pairwise, there is little chance they will arrive by themselves at this redistribution of goods. So if you look at, for instance, Bart here and so Bart here and Barney, if you need to refresh your memory on The Simpsons. So Bart has a hot dog and he wants a slingshot. Barney has a slingshot, so he has something that is of interest to Bart, but Bart has nothing that is of interest to Barney. And the same is true for any other pair of individual here. Homer has a beer, which is of no interest to Bart. Bart has something which is of interest to Homer, but they have no chance to exchange in such a situation, and likewise for Barney and Homer. So without money, the problem is, so the standard theory maintains, that there are a lot of better distribution of goods that are not going to be reached because the agent in those economy cannot know how to redistribute their goods. So now, how does money solve that? Again, according to the standard commodity theory of money. Suppose that Bart, who has a hot dog, he still wants a slingshot. He realized that nobody wants to trade a slingshot against a hot dog. But he has an idea. He says to himself, okay, a slingshot is really what I want most. But I have noticed that on the market, everybody loves donuts. It's very easy on the market. Everybody seems to be willing to get donuts. So perhaps if I can get donuts against my hot dog, in the end, I may be able to get the slingshot against a donut. And independently, according again to the standard commodity theory, Barney has the same reasoning. Nobody, so he wants a beer, nobody wants to exchange a beer against the slingshot he has, but he noticed that everybody is willing to have donuts. So he thinks, perhaps if I can get donuts, then in the second time I can get the beer against the donuts, and Homer does the same. So now the only thing, if all of these agents arrive at the same reasoning, and they can do so according to the theory independently, they just observe that there is a kind of commodity which is really strongly desired on the market, and they think, okay, if I get that commodity, which is very vendible, it will be easy to get what I really want. The only thing we need now is that anybody on the picture has some amount of that commodity. So let's give a donut to Bart. And now it's kind of obvious that there is a mutually beneficial exchange between Bart and Barney. Namely, Bart prefer to have a slingshot rather than having a donut, while Barney prefer to have a donut rather than having a slingshot, so they both exchange. Likewise now, Barney prefer having beers rather than having a donut, while Homer prefer having a donut rather than having beer, so they exchange. And likewise, between Homer and Bart. So the donut here is the money. It has played just a role of a medium of exchange, and it has solved the problem of double coincidence of ones, because each agent has independently, I mean, there is no collective intentionality on that story. Each agent has independently been looking for the donuts, the money, that has in the end allowed him to get the good he wanted first, right? So if we generalize now, how can we define that standard commodity theory of money? So the first element of the theory is a thing about the function of money. It says that X is money relative to a group if X is a commodity that is used as a medium of exchange among the members of that group. It's not easy, in fact, to precisely define medium of exchange here, but a rough definition will be enough for the present purpose. It's basically something that you accept in exchange of something else, not because you really want it, but because you plan to re-exchange it afterwards against what you really want. The second element of the standard commodity theory is a claim about the origin of money. It's the idea that money was spontaneously selected as a medium of exchange in an initial situation of barter, in which X was just a commodity amongst others. So there was donuts to start with. They were not money, but they became money when people started converging towards money in order to get what they really wanted. Here is Menger, one of the most famous proponents, and arguably the first proponent of the view. Money is not the product of an agreement on the part of economizing men, nor the product of legislative acts. No one invented it. So you can arrive at money just spontaneously here. Manuel, you mentioned before some text that you were wondering why Searle didn't read it. I have the same question about Menger. It's really surprising that he doesn't seem to consider that view, which do away with collective intentionality as the origin of money. Third claim, constitutive of the standard commodity theory. Money as a commodity must be a physical thing, something material. Why is that so? Some say it is just what a commodity is. A commodity must be tangible or material. But usually, Menger, for instance, and others give a more detailed reason why money must be material and a specific kind of material. So first, money is something you accept in exchange and then you want to re-exchange. So money, you should be able to store it. If you have fruit, this is poor money because they get rotten, and if you want to buy something with your apple 2 weeks after, it's not going to be easy. So donuts is not a bad example. They must be divisible, is not a good example, sorry. They must be divisible, ideally. If coals become money, I mean, it's not easy to buy an apple with a coal because you cannot cut the coal right amount of value. They must be easily transferable. It's better if you can have it with you. I mean, a coal is, if you go to the market with your coal, it's not very handy. So that's why they say metals are going to be the best probably, I mean, it's not an essential commitment of the theory, but it's something that's easy to store, that's precious, you can have it in your pocket, you can divide it easily, it does not corrupt easily, so there is a good chance that precious metal are going to be money. And the last claim of the theory is that since money is a commodity that has been selected to become a medium of exchange, then money had an economic value before becoming money. So donuts were desired before they became money. Gold was desired before it became money. Okay. So that's what is called the standard commodity theory of money. And now that theory has been objected three different things. So the first one is that history, the claim about the origin of money is completely wrong. This is an objection that has been leveled by sociologists, anthropologists, and historians who said, no, in fact, humanity was never in a situation of barter in which we had to converge towards the same kind of commodity. Right from the beginning, from all the documents we have, there was a system of debts and claims in which people could solve, in a way we will be considering at the end of the talk, the problem of lack of double coincidence of wants. So there is kind of myth of barter, which is just empirically false, or so those objectors argue. The second objection to the standard commodity theory of money is to say, well, that was fine at the time of Adam Smith and Menger, perhaps, but now we are all familiar with immaterial form of money, electronic money, cryptocurrencies, and clearly this is not a commodity. These are not commodities, tangible commodities. Okay, you cannot put any of this piece of money in your pocket, while as a theory is committed to money being material. And the third objection is the objection from fiat money. So now there is most of money we have started to be money right from the very beginning of its existence. So if you look at the bills you have in your wallet, it was not first a piece of paper that was used for drawing and then we ascribe to it some function that let's count that as money. No, it was money right from the beginning. It was not intended. It never had any economic value prior to its monetary value. So here is just one instance of the last objection. If there never had been anything but a metallic currency, the commodity theory would have been sufficient. And such was the case when the conception originated. In modern times, however, an engine of a much more complicated nature has been devised, namely credit or paper currency. Now, our reason for rejecting the conception of money, which is in general use, is that it is wholly incapable of solving the more intricate and important problems in the paper currency. So MacLeod is going to be the first proponent of the claim theory, which I'm going to criticize later on. So if we reject the standard commodity theory, what are the alternatives? I just mentioned four main alternatives here, but I will only discuss the first. The first alternative is the claim theory, is to try to account for what money is in terms of debt, credits, or claim. Another theory, which is more recent by a philosopher and economist, is to say that money, in fact, corresponds to abstract position on a ratio scale. It's never material, it's just different positions which are associated with each economic agent. Those two theories accept that money are objects, also money is an object of special non-material kinds. Then there are the two next theory who reject that money is an object. So Cohen, the philosopher, defended that money is in fact never an object, it's the power of an agent. So money is my power to purchase a certain amount. Thing. And then more recently, Gwala defended rule theory in which he emphatically rejects the fact that money is ever an object, and he says money is a set of rules in equilibrium. So I won't discuss the three last one, but the reason I mentioned this is that I think we have been too quick in giving up on the essential insight of the commodity theory, and that there was some very easy fix to the objection I just mentioned to the standard commodity theory. So that's the standard commodity theory. What is now the pure commodity theory? It's very simple. You start with a standard commodity theory. You keep the first claim. X is a commodity used as a medium of exchange against member of G. You drop any claim about the origin of money. That is, this amounts to say that it is not part of the nature of money that it originated in one way or in another. So for the pure commodity theory, something can be money if it arises spontaneously a la Menger. Something can be money if it arises thanks to collective intentionality a la Searle. We collectively decide to count that as money now. Or something can be money if the king, if François tells us now you use that as money and this is just authoritative act. And so these are all various possible ways in which money can come to be, but these are not parts of what money is. What about the constitution of money? Here again, the pure commodity theory remains neutral. It accepts that money is a commodity, but it maintains that commodity might be either tangible or intangible, and I shall argue in a minute that this makes perfect sense, that the notion of intangible commodities is in fact needed. And what about the former, the independent value of money? Here again, the pure commodity theory does not take any commitment about that. Some form of money may have value before becoming money, or some other form of money, fiat money, may never have had any value before they became money. So now it should be pretty obvious that the three objections to the standard commodity theory have no grip on the pure commodity theory, since the pure commodity theory makes no claims about the history of money. The objection falls. It makes no claim about money being material or not. It accepts explicitly that commodity can be intangibles, so no objection here. And it accepts that as well, that money can be fiat or non-fiat, that it may or not have had value before becoming money, so no problem here. So, I mean, this, in a way, this seems to be a very cheap move, but I'm surprised that I fail to see any strong problem given the reason advanced for rejecting commodity theory for the pure commodity theory. So this is just an attempt at mapping the various commodity theories. All agree that money is a commodity used as a member, as a medium of exchange. But then you have impure commodity theory, which add various forms of restriction on either the origin of money, the constitution of money, the value of money. They may be different. So you might, here you have Menger, who say money arises spontaneously. Here you have Searle, who say money arises from collective intentionality. The pure commodity theory is entirely non-committal with respect to any of these further restriction. So now, when should I stop, Kevin? Sorry.
You started at 35 minutes after the hour. So you've been speaking for 24 minutes.
Okay, thanks. Natural question now is, so I'm claiming that a commodity can be intangible. Does that even make sense? Can we still speak of a commodity theory if one accepts that commodity can be intangible? So the chief question is here is to understand what is a commodity. One thing that seems largely accepted is that a commodity or a good, I'm not going to distinguish them here, is something that is vendible, tradable, or up for sale. So that's what Smith, Menger say, and many early economists, classics and neoclassics, agree on. So the first essential feature of a commodity is that it must be exchangeable. Okay, that's, I take to be uncontroversial. But now, that's not enough to get a commodity, because there are many things that are exchangeable which are not commodities, namely all the services. So what is the difference between services and commodity? Let me drop the last point. The proposal is that a commodity is an exchangeable continuant. A continuant is an entity that persists over time without having temporal parts. So we all are continuants. That table is a continuant. Trees are continuants. Many things are continuous. That talk is not a continuous, it's an occurrence. It persists over time while having temporal parts. When Kevin opened that workshop saying, I hereby declare the conference open, that was not a continuance either. That was an occurrence, not in the sense in which it persists over time while having temporal part, but in the sense in which it was an instantaneous act, which does not persist over time. So continuance are entities which persist over time without having temporal part, and that's the reason why if we define commodity in terms of exchangeable continuance, we exclude first services, and we exclude second abstract entities which are outside time and space. So that's very simple categorization of the kind of things which can be exchanged. Some of them are continuance, we call them commodities, some of them are occurrence, we call them services. Now, back to the question, can there be intangible commodities? And here my answer is an emphatic yes, there must be tangible commodities, intangible commodities. Let me give you a couple of examples. A printed book is a tangible commodity. A PDF book is an intangible commodity. A computer is tangible. A software is intangible. A violin is a tangible commodity. A musical composition is intangible. A library is a tangible commodity. The right to access a library is intangible. A beer is a tangible commodity. A claim to a beer from Kevin, who promised me a beer, is an intangible commodity. Okay. So if you look at the right of the screen now, you have things which persist over time without having temporal parts, but you cannot touch them, so they are not physical things. You cannot have them in your pocket. But still, you can exchange them. Okay? You can buy software. You can, if Kevin promised a beer to me, with the agreement of Kevin, perhaps I can give my claim to Catherine, and now Catherine has a claim to a beer from Kevin. So these are exchangeables and intangible. Okay, so that completes the picture of all the exchangeable entities. So now back to back to money. Sorry. So I'm doing all this to convince you that it's perfectly okay to have intangible commodity. If you are not yet convinced, I want to insist that there are three conflations that have led to the idea that all commodities in economics must be material. The first one is the conflation between services and intangible entities. It should be clear by now why these are not the same thing, but a taxi drive is genuinely a service. While the example I gave to you, copyrights and so on, they are clearly commodities. There are a few clues that these are importantly different. A first clue is that you can transfer commodities, even intangible ones, but you cannot transfer services. So if you buy a taxi drive, it's not the case that the taxi driver had a drive and then give it to you, and now you have a drive. No, that's not the way. But if you have the right to do something, you can transfer that right to somebody else, and then you first have the right and the other people get the right. Another important distinction between services and immaterial commodities is that you can accumulate immaterial commodities. You cannot accumulate services. You cannot say, well, I took the taxi this morning and this afternoon. Now I have two taxi drives, and I hope to have 10 taxi drives by the end of the week. You are not richer by the end of the week if you have a lot of taxi drives. While if by the end of the week people have been sending to you a lot of PDF documents, software, or whatever, you are in that sense richer. You have accumulated those intangible commodities. So important distinction not to overlook here. A second reason why people have been tempted by commodity materialism, I think, is the confusion between notion of transfer of commodity and the notion of motion of commodity. So sometimes commodity are called movables. So the thought is, if we can move commodity, they must be in space, they must be tangible. If they can move on a cargo ship, I mean, how can they move on a cargo ship if they are not physical things? So what's the answer to that? The answer to that is that there is a mistake about what we mean by transferring a commodity. Transferring a commodity does not, you don't, to transfer a commodity, you do not need any cargo ships, you do not need even strong muscle. You just need those very small muscle here. You just say, I hereby transfer to you, blah, blah, blah. So if François tells me now in the proper context, I hereby transfer to you the ownership of my house in the south of France, which I encourage you to do, then thereby I become the owner of the house. Nothing has moved, right? It's just, and why is that possible? Because transferring is a transfer of ownership, okay? We transfer the ownership of the things to one person to another. So there is no way, there is no reason to move the object that is being transferred. Of course, in many cases, this will be important. I mean, just becoming the owner of a baguette without having the baguette in your hand is not very important. So there will also have to be a service of delivering the baguette to the people who buy it, who becomes the owner of it. But that's a service. That's not what, and that's not a transfer. And the last conflation that led to commodity materialism is the fact that we tend to conflate what represents some intangible commodities with those commodities themselves. So the point was raised early by Barry Smith in Objection to Searle about electronic money. Smith objected to Searle's, the blips on a computer, they are not money, they represent money. These are not themselves the money we use, but these are records of money. Likewise, if you buy a ticket for a great concert, that ticket represents your right to enter the concert, but it's not itself the right. I mean, you usually, except for fetishistic reasons, you usually don't care about the piece of paper here. You care about the right it gives to you, namely to enter the room and attend the concert. So the piece of paper stands for an intangible commodity, namely the right to attend the concert. Okay, so that's the pure commodity theory of money. Once again, money is any medium of exchange which is a continuant, and that includes both tangible and intangible commodity, and we have independent reasons to take intangible commodity as a very important category of object in the ontology of economics. I'm aiming at 12:15, am I right?
Yeah, you can go on a bit longer because we started late, because we're not in Switzerland.
So let's move now to the, so that's the theory I think is true. Let's move now to the theory I think is false, but which is one main contender. Arguably the most popular theory nowadays about money. Here is Schumpeter, who said more than one century ago, there are only two theories of money which deserve the name, the commodity theory and the claim theory. And he has a kind of strong preference for the claim theory, so with some quibbles I shall not discuss here. So what is the claim theory of money? So the claim theory of money is the idea that money is a kind of claim and that it's not based on any metallic commodity. So the initial motivation of the theory is the objection I mentioned formerly, dissatisfaction with the standard commodity theory of money. We have seen the objection of MacLeod. Here are some other chief defenders of this theory, Mitchell Hines, more recently Ingham and David Graeber. This is just a note. But if you are going to argue that money is a kind of claim, the problem of trust is going to be really central to you, and that's why people who go in that direction often ascribe a central role to the state in the issuing of money. Because if I just issue a claim to you, I make some promise to you. If we don't know each other, you may say, "No, who is this guy who promised me a lot, and perhaps he will never deliver." While if the state and the proper institution are in place, perhaps that problem is going to be easier to solve. So this is just to say that the upholder of the claim theory, they have a more statist inclination in terms of political economy, while the commodity theorists have a more liberal or minimal state inclination. But that's just contingent. I think we should not conflate that with important discussion about the nature of money. So that's not a political matter here. So now the claim theory, how should we articulate it clearly? And that's where it's becoming really tricky. When you read the claim theorist, they make many claims, and it seems like very more like a variety of theory, and it's never exactly clear what they mean. So I think one clear distinction is the following. They are first a simple claim theorist, and what they say is that money is a claim to be provided with something later on, which we get in exchange of some things that we provide right now. Okay, so money is a claim we get, and we hope to have something later on, and those claim theorists maintain that this is all what money is, there is nothing else that is needed. And then there is another kind of claim theory, which say that, no, that's not quite enough to turn a claim into money. The claim on top of that must be transferable. So money is a transferable claim to be provided with something later on, which we get in exchange, the claim, we get in exchange of something which we provide now. Okay. So these are the two main versions of the claim theory. I will give you a few quotes in a minute. But just to tell you where I'm going, I think the first version of the claim theory does not solve the problem of double coincidence of ones. So if we think that money has to solve that problem, we have to reject the first version. And I think the second version of the claim theory, namely the idea that money is a transferable claim, is just a version of commodity theory in disguise, so it's not an alternative to commodity theory. So let's start with the simple claim theory. So upholder of that view, they think that their view can solve the problem of double coincidence of ones. And so I disagree, but why do they think so? Go back to an initial situation, which is a bit different now. So Bart has a donut. He wants a slingshot. Homer wants a donut, but he has no slingshot to offer. How can they proceed? Well, Homer can just say to Bart, I promise to give you a slingshot later on. We are all Reinachian here, so we know that by the very nature of that act, two new kinds of objects came to existence, namely a claim on the side of Bart. Bart now has a claim to a slingshot, and Homer now has an obligation or a duty to provide a slingshot to Bart. Okay. And Bart may be okay with that and think, okay, I don't have a slingshot yet, but now I have a claim to a slingshot, so I'm okay to give to Homer my donut. And how do we move away? So suppose at some point Homer gets a donut, he cooks it, he gets it from another exchange. That does not matter. Then Homer gives, Homer was already, makes the example. Homer already has a donut, but he gets a slingshot, okay? He construes it himself, or he buys it from somebody else, or he's offered it, whatever. When Homer gets the slingshot, he can transfer the slingshot to Bart, and everything is good now. The claim and the obligation disappeared because they have been satisfied, and both agents have what they wanted, okay? So thanks to the arising of debts and obligations, through promises, we have solved a situation in which there was no double coincidence of ones. So that's David Graeber, who considers a situation like this. Let me read it. In any of these scenarios, this exact scenario exactly similar to the one I just mentioned, the problem of double coincidence of want, so endlessly invoked in the economics textbook, simply disappears. Henry might not have something Joshua wants right now, but if the two are neighbors, it's obviously only a matter of time before he will. The point is so obvious that it's amazing it hasn't been made more often. The only classical economist I'm aware of who appears to have considered the possibility that deferred payment might have made barter unnecessary is Ralph Hawtrey, whom I don't know, by the way. But so the idea is for Graeber and many others, it's kind of obvious if you have that possibility, you have an alternative solution to the problem of double coincidence of wants. Here is one very early proponent of the simple theory, Mitchell Hines. Let me just read the passage in bold. There is absolutely no reason for assuming the existence of so clumsy a device as a medium of exchange when so simple a system would do all that was required. And he described exactly what we have now, the kind of promises to deliver later on what you cannot deliver now as a solution to the problem. So, what's the objection to the proposal? It's true that the theory provides a solution to the lack of double coincidence of ones in some cases. So the case in which there are no double coincidence of one, the case in which A trust B, Bart trust that Homer will deliver, makes a sincere promise. But also an even more condition which is even more difficult to satisfy, A believes that B will at some point provide him with what he wants, and he also believes A is that when B will deliver, he will still be willing to have it. So if Homer promised to deliver a slingshot to Bart in 10 years, it's unlikely that in 10 years Bart is still willing to have a slingshot. So that's a lot of conditions to satisfy. And clearly they will not cover all the cases, and I think they will not cover most of the cases. So consider the original case we started from, the standard way of putting the lack of coincidence of one, in which we have three people. A wants what B has, B wants what C has, and C wants what A has. In such a case, there is no clear solution just with promise of deferred payment. So one way to realize that is to think of this that way. So the only way you can offer, so suppose you want a piece of butter to the cheesemonger, okay? There is no money yet. You have nothing that is of interest to the cheesemonger. So what do we do? You tell him, I will come back next week and wash your car. Then you go to the butcher. You have nothing which is of interest to the butcher, and you tell him, I will repaint your house next week. So this is the way you multiply promises like this. So now open your fridge. Is it really the case that for every item that you have in your fridge, there is or there has been a kind of claim, a commitment you have been making for rendering a service or sending or delivering a commodity to these people? Clearly not. I mean, it seems to describe a situation which sometimes happens, but it's very rare. Most often, we have just used money as a medium of exchange, and it would be really problematic if we had to, if this was the only way for us to convince others to give us what we want. So that's why many claim theorists have, consciously or not, it's not always completely clear, move to another version of the claim theory. They say that X is money relative to a certain group, G, if X is a claim that is transferable among the member of G. And that might solve, and I agree with that might solve the problem of double coincidence of one. So how does it work? So let's start again with the case. So at the end of the former situation, Bart now just gain a claim to get a slingshot from Homer. What can Bart do with that claim he just got from his exchange with Homer? The first thing is that he can redeem the claim. So he can go to Homer and say, now I want my slingshot. Homer gives the slingshot to Bart and the claim is over. That is what we considered before. But now suppose that Bart, he has the claim, but there is something that he wants even more than a slingshot, namely a skateboard. And he meets Milouz, who has a skateboard and who would rather have a skateboard. And then in such a case, Bart might just trade the skateboard against the claim to a slingshot, okay? So that requires Homer to agree with that. So Homer must have agreed to give to Bart a transferable claim, but let's assume it's the case. So now Milouz has a claim to get a slingshot from Homer. He might himself redeem the claim, but that claim himself, he may transfer it to get something he wants even more than the claim shot. So you see that claim here becomes to be a medium of exchange that travels from one agent to another, and it becomes money. That's exactly the contention of MacLeod. We may now suppose that the second person, the end of the quote, we may now suppose that the second person has dealing with a third and requires his service, but that the third has no immediate use for the service of the second, but requires use of the first. Now, if these parties were so circumstanced, what could be more natural for the second to transfer to the third the debt due to him from the first? And here is Graeber, which oscillates between simple claim theory and transferable claim theory. So he describes the same kind of situation. But say Joshua were to pass the IOU, the debt, onto a third party, Sheila, to whom he owes something else. He could take it off against his debt to a fourth party, Lola. Now Henry will owe that amount to her. Hence, money is bond. So what Graeber is saying is that as soon as debt claims begin to be exchanged, then you have money. So what's the objection to that? So that's a second version of the claim theory. What's the objection? I'm nearly finished. What's the objection to that theory? The transferable claim theory, I contend, is a version of impure theory of commodity theory of money. I forgot commodity. It's an impure commodity theory of money. Why is that so? Because first, claims are clearly commodities. Why? They are exchangeable and they are immaterial, so they pass from hand to hand. And we have seen that that's what an immaterial commodity is. And now the transferable claim clearly behaves exactly as a media of exchange. So you have a claim to something, and instead of redeeming it, instead of using it to get what you want, you use it just in order to get the other thing you want. So it's just transforming a claim into a medium of exchange. So there is nothing really new under the sun here. So that's the first and main objection to the transferable claim theory. The second objection is that since it is an impure commodity theory, it's kind of overgeneralized because it maintains that all money has to be claimed. And that even if it's mostly true in contemporary economics, it's perfectly okay to say, no, in prisons, money sometimes are not claimed with cigarettes, or money once was gold, and so on. So it adds a new unnecessary restriction on what money is. It has to be intangible, according to the theory, since claims are intangible, but tangible money should not be forbidden. So that's in a nutshell the critique of the claim theory. So what should we conclude from that into picture? The first is there are indeed some defects to the standard commodity theory, but we have been too keen in rejecting the whole theory and looking for complete alternatives. So there was a core to the theory which still stands, and even the alleged main alternative to the theory, namely the claim theory, in fact agree with what I've been calling the pure commodity theory. So we shouldn't throw away the baby with the bathwater. And the second concluding picture is that the commodity theory is a far more big monster that includes a lot of the alleged alternative to it. So the transferable claim theory is in fact one version of the commodity theory. It's true there is another claim theory, the simple claim theory. It's not a version of the commodity theory, but it doesn't work anyway to solve the real problem, most of the problem of double coincidence of wants. So we should all go back to the good old commodity theory of money. Thanks for your attention.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.